The following is a 1500 ESPN Twin Cities production.
Raised on basketball, raised in front of a computer screen, raised for covering the game, raised by wolves. Now, talking all things Timberwolves with beat writer Derek James, here's Benny Hill with the Raised by Wolves podcast.
And we are back for another edition of Raised by Wolves. Thanks so much for listening. We are presented to you by TCL, America's fastest growing TV brand and official TV of the Minnesota Timberwolves. And Derek, that was a fun game on Tuesday, the Wolves and Sixers, and they put on quite a show. The Sixers win in overtime. Lots to digest if you're a Wolves fan. A lot of angst from I think media members and fans alike. I think everybody that's been paying attention to this team this year is maybe a little bit frustrated with the minutes distribution among the starters and a lot of other things.
I've seen some people, and rightfully so, say, "Hey, you know what? They're still 16-12. They're fourth-ish in the West." But it's you still look at the process that's leading to the results. No pun intended here. Now that we talk about the Sixers later, and you just kind of you have some questions and some areas for improvement as the season goes on.
Yeah, I think my biggest gripe, and if you're listening and you follow me on Twitter, you probably noticed my biggest gripe last night was the amount of minutes that Taj played, which ended up being 40. He fouled out of the game in overtime.
I joked on Twitter that he fouled himself out just to get himself a rest.
Well, that's what it kind of seemed like, though, right? Like, it just seemed like he had nothing left, and I wasn't at the game. You were there. You were at the arena.
He had played 33 minutes at the end of the third quarter. The end of the third quarter, he could barely stand up. He was kind of stammering around, trying to keep his feet and hands on his legs, the works. I mean, he was gassing. People on Twitter kept, saying, "What is Taj doing? I can't, why did he, let his guy go to the basket?" Well, because he's gassed.
His tank is on E. That's why he's out of gas.
Well, the thing that kills me is Gorgui Dieng was having a good night, but he had only played 8 minutes at that point.
Yeah.
We've all seen the Gorgui Dieng nights where, he should only play 8 nights. That was not one of those nights. And those nights are few and far between from Gorgui. So, yeah, that's frustrating.
Yeah, I just don't, from my perspective, I just don't understand when you have a quality rotation big like Gorgui Dieng, who gives you, he's going to play some defense for you. He's going to rebound a little bit. He just does a little bit of everything for you that you can ask out of a rotation big. And we're 36 minutes into the game and Taj has played 33 of them. I just don't understand.
And Cole Aldridge, we've talked about it. He's a little plodding in today's NBA. He doesn't have much range at all, but he's good enough to eat a couple fouls for you, grab a board here and there, maybe gets a putback. And he's a big dude. You're not just moving him out of the paint. So, why not just play him even just 5 minutes and give him a little breather?
Yeah, I just don't know if I can't imagine Tibbs thinks that sustaining an 8-man rotation for the remainder of 54 games they have left now. I just can't imagine that he thinks that that's sustainable. At least I hope he doesn't think that that's sustainable. It might be a problem if he does think that. But we do have a guest on with us this week, and he covers the Philadelphia 76ers, who were in town, of course, to play the Wolves on Tuesday night. He covers the Sixers for the Philly Voice. Kyle Newbeck is with us. Did I say your last name right, Kyle?
Yes, you did.
Great. I nailed it on the first time. I appreciate that. We appreciate you being on, and that was a fun game last night for sure.
Yeah, I always think this game is a good litmus test for both these teams, because I think with the exception of Jimmy Butler, who's got a little more experience, the stars or like the young core pieces on both teams are right around the same age, and so these teams are going to be compared for a long time, especially Karl Towns and Joel Embiid, because they're going to be going one-on-one in a lot of different instances. And last night's the first game that I can remember. I think the first time they played last year in Minnesota, Towns didn't do a whole lot of actually guarding Embiid. That task was left to some other guys, but you had to see them go one-on-one a lot last night, and I thought Towns did at least in the individual coverage, he did a pretty good job giving Embiid some trouble. So it was a fun preview of what's hopefully a nice little rivalry for years to come.
What about Ben Simmons? And he's, I mean, from a number standpoint, he's been the best rookie of this season, and I think he's easily the front runner for the Rookie of the Year award this year. But how has he sort of fit in with the rest of this group? I mean, it's been a long time coming, the process, if you will, that Sam Hinkie started many years ago. But how is Ben Simmons fitting in with the rest of these guys that they've kind of put together over the last few years?
I think he's the type of guy that, because of the way he thinks and plays basketball, he's going to be able to fit with almost anybody. Because, I mean, you guys saw the extreme version of it last night, where he really didn't shoot all that much throughout the game. He was more concerned with making the pass to hit an open shooter in the corner. There's even a play where he got, I forget who it was, it might have been Teague or Gibson inside. One of them jumped on a pump fake, and he drew the foul, but he never put the shot up and was in the process of tossing that out to an open shooter in the corner, which that's one of those where you're getting fouled by the rim. Just throw the ball up, get the free throws. So there's a little bit of, like, look, dude, you got to shoot the ball more. But the good side of it is you see him in transition, Rashawn Holmes getting up the court, and he's hitting them with a lob for a dunk from half court. And you really just don't see many players, period, who are capable of putting a pass on a rope like that, let alone a guy who's 6'10", athletic freak like he is. So, I mean, I think he's been great. I think as far as how he's handled himself, he's been great as well. I know there were some character and does he have what it takes to win type questions coming out of LSU because he put on that weird team down there and they didn't get to the tournament, so all the assorted questions you hear there. But I mean, he's just as good as it seems the national press believes he is, and watching him every day has really been a treat for a guy in his first year.
Well, what I've noticed, I mean, Manny and I talked about before, you know, when he was at LSU, about how he didn't really have much of a jumper, but then, you know, once I finally watched him, you realize that really doesn't matter when he's as athletic and as quick as he is with that length. It really doesn't matter. And I mean, defensively, what we saw last night is that when, you know, the Wolves would go to throw a pass, Ben Simmons is 6'10". I mean, that leaves J.J. Redick, the shortest guy on the court, at 6'5". That's throwing it through a sea of arms. I mean, that's really hard to, you know, connect a pass on a defense that has that kind of size.
Yeah, and to your point about the jumper specifically, I think what's interesting about Simmons compared to, like, your average player that doesn't have an outside shot, like, let's say Russell Westbrook. He's a guy that teams would be happy if he just stood on the perimeter and shot threes all game, because the other things he does when he slashes and kicks are much more damaging. But Simmons, even though teams are playing 5'10", sometimes 15 feet off of him, he doesn't get lulled into that false sense of security. He doesn't have any interest in taking what he feels is a bad shot. Now, sometimes that cuts the other way, and it becomes a problem where the teams will just force him to either take a shot or you're not getting anything at the rim, and then the offense sort of stagnates. But there is a bit of heads-up play there. To your point about the defense, I think right now he's more of a, let's say, a flashy defender than he is a good defender. He's still a rookie, so he does a lot of gambling. He away from the ball, he gets caught ball-watching sometimes, and I think guys like LeBron, especially when he's been matched up with the higher caliber wings, they'll take advantage of that tendency to jump out in the passing lanes. But you're right. When they run out these lineups where the smallest guy on the court is J.J. Redick, and you have guys that are all 6'9 and up clogging up the passing lanes, I mean, there's the potential for a terrifying defense, and that's all without Markelle Fultz even being a part of the equation for them yet.
Yeah, what's your assessment of Markelle Fultz? I know he's been injured, but when he was out there, he was struggling at the free throw line, which was mind-boggling to me because I didn't foresee that at all. But what's your take on how, when he does come back, how he can sort of fit into this mold? Because he was kind of the lead guard when he was at Washington, and now he's kind of in a situation where He may have to play off the ball a little bit more with Simmons kind of being the de facto point guard. So how can Fultz sort of fit into this mold?
Well, I got to tell you, man, after watching the first four games of Markelle Fultz professionally, comparing that against Washington, I have no idea what he's going to come back and play. I thought I knew who Markelle Fultz was. He was my favorite prospect in the draft. I don't think that was an unpopular opinion. I mean, he looked great at Washington despite, again, another poor team performance while he was there. But this whole thing has just really screwed with my perception of all that. So part of me wants to just wait and see. Hopefully there's not any permanent changes. If we're going to assume that we get UW, Markelle Fultz, and this is all an aberration, I think the plan initially is going to be Markelle will get eased in. He'll play with that second unit and be sort of the de facto leader of that second group. So he'll be asked to take on a lot of the same responsibilities he did at Washington. They need him to score. They need him to distribute to guys. They need him to do pretty much everything that you would expect a lead guard to do in the NBA. But eventually you also want him to take that starting spot in the lineup, taking out most likely Dario Saric. And so it'll look like Fultz, Covington, Simmons, Embiid, and J.J. Redick will be the five on the floor. So then it'll be a case where him and Ben are going to have to figure out how to handle the ball handling duties and split that up. And I think Ben is already sort of prepared for that because he spent a lot of his life as a forward or a more traditional power forward. Like last night, you guys saw a little bit towards the end of the game. He posted guys up. He worked out of the paint. And I think you can ask him to do that for stretches. But because he's such a special talent with the ball in his hands, you don't necessarily want to have him just camping out on the low block all day. I think the one big advantage of Fultz's return is it's going to allow them to stagger those two and to have potentially elite-level shot creators in both the first and second unit, or at least having one of those each at the same time, which their bench has been pretty bad this year. So that's going to be a big boost for the Sixers once Fultz gets up to speed, assuming he's not the guy we saw in the first four games of the year with that broken free throw.
Yeah, the free throw shooting to me was just mind-boggling.
It was bizarre. The guy was an elite-level scorer at three levels in college, and then he gets to the NBA, and it looks like he'd never taken a shot before. It was crazy.
Words really don't do that free throw for him justice. Did he even need to change it? Didn't he just kind of take that upon himself?
Well, that's the root of the question here. Even the team has said three different things. Brett Brown came out the first day we asked about it. It was he made some change. He was tweaking it a little bit while he's away from the team. We had nothing to do with it, et cetera, et cetera. Then later on it became, that was prompted by a shoulder thing. And so then it became a question about it's a chicken or the egg thing, and how much is the shoulder playing into it, how much of it is he just trying to rush through changing his shot mechanics. So I'll tell you, I hope he gets back to those original mechanics, because I don't know what the hell that abomination was that he showed off at the beginning of the year.
We're talking with Kyle Newbeck of the Philly Voice, phillyvoice.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at Kyle Newbeck. So the Sixers made this trade. They sent Jahlil Okafor to Brooklyn, and they get Trevor Booker in return. What do you think of his fit and sort of how he fits in with this mix? What does he sort of bring to the table for them?
So I have enjoyed the Trevor Booker experience so far. I think he's one of those guys that everywhere that he's been, he plays real hard. He's a worker on defense and offense. Defense, you see it where he really, once he has the scheme down, I think he'll be a better defender than he's been in Philly so far. But he doesn't really get beat on his assignments. He crashes the glass at both ends, and he's a great character, locker room guy. You always hear all his teammates rave about him. I think he won over Philadelphia pretty quickly because the way he described himself in an interview was he's a bigger TJ McConnell. And TJ is a very, very popular guy around Philadelphia just because he's a, a hard nose. Like, Philly loves those type of guys.
Yes, I mean, they do.
Basketball fans in general always admire guys who get in the muck and just mix things up. So I think Booker is going to be a big addition, not a big addition, but he's somebody that just gives them some more depth, some more toughness on the back end of that rotation. And he gives you the flexibility, too, if you want to downsize and play somebody like him at a center, he's not going to hurt you. So if you want to give teams different looks, he gives you some positional flexibility that I think will be really nice as well.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think I'm just happy that I don't have to talk about Jahlil Okafor anymore because the whole saga has gone on just a little too long for my liking.
See, I had always been a Trevor Booker fan ever since I actually saw his draft workout in Minneapolis. Quincy Pondexter was there. Luke Babbitt was there. Pondexter embarrassed Babbitt all day, just abused him defensively. But Trevor Booker, I mean, you just see this 6'6 power forward down there just bruising it with the bigger guys. He just never stops moving. And then you see him in person up close, and he's a big, thick dude. I mean, once he's in position at that size, you're not moving him. And yeah, like you said, I mean, he's just a hard-nosed player that he's hard not to like, and he's one of those guys where I'm like, did the Wolves have just called and, you know, just said, you know, asked what they could have got him for? I mean, he's right. A hard guy not to like. But, you know, I'd be curious to get your thoughts on what the Jahlil Okafor experience kind of was over the year. Because it seemed like it really drug out, and it kind of became kind of a debacle, you know, from the outside looking in.
Yeah, I mean, being there day to day, it's not like he was so. What you see from the outside pretty much is you see the Woj report, and you hear whenever Okafor made like a couple complaints to the media, maybe like one or two days where he spoke at practice where he was kind of visibly upset about the whole thing. But other than that, I mean, he was pretty harmonious with the staff and the rest of his teammates there. It was never a situation where there was any kind of real animosity in the building. They were doing all kinds of individual workouts with him day after day after day. He was pretty good friends with Joel Embiid, who obviously is the best guy on the team, pretty much the de facto team leader as a result of that. So he's very much included within the fabric of the team, at least as far as everybody getting along and just being a cohesive unit. But from his perspective, look, I get it. I mean, he sees where he is on the depth chart. Before he's traded, he was realistically the fifth option at center. And I say five because Brett Brown had gone to Dario Saric in some of those small ball lineups before he would go to Okafor. And Okafor had only played in two games all year while he was here. So it was made pretty clear that he wasn't in the long-term plans here, especially when they didn't pick up the option. And after a certain point when they weren't getting anything back for him, at least anything of real value, I think it was time to move on. So I'm glad that he'll get to go to a team where maybe he'll get to fight for more minutes. I think Brooklyn has more of a chance for him to earn his way into that rotation, whereas the Sixers are just, look, they're trying to win games. They don't have time to give a ton of developmental minutes to a guy they believe is the fifth best center on the team. So I hope it works out for him up there. He's a good kid, never caused much trouble down here, but it was definitely time for him to leave for greener pastures.
Well, it just seems like with the Sixers, I mean, Okafor kind of looked up this year, and I mean, Amir Johnson isn't what he used to be, but he's still, you know, a savvy vet who knows what to do on the court and where to be in that sense. But now, you know, there's also, you know, Rashawn Holmes has been a fantastic player, and he's a guy that I always forget about. So it's kind of an embarrassment of riches for bigs in Philly. And if you're not exactly what the team's thinking of, you're going to be, you know, on the outside looking in.
Yeah, it was always sort of a square peg, round hole situation, even from the time that he was drafted here. And that first year really it screwed with the perception, I think, of both for him individually and nationally. I mean, I know he put up big numbers, but he did so on a team that obviously was really bad. And so he has the argument in his head, and rightfully so, that he still produced despite an absence of talent around him, being put in a a bad situation. So he looks at that and says, look, I deserve to continue getting more and more opportunities. And the new management comes in and they say, well, when you were the tip of the spear, the team was really bad, and we see lots of deficiencies in your game, and we want to prioritize other minutes. And I think once Joel Embiid enters the picture, it becomes pretty clear, like, look, that's the guy. Like, you don't have a chance to be the starter here unless there is some kind of catastrophic injury. So I think Okafor always knew once the Embiid train got going that if he wanted to be the player that I guess he believes he can be, it was always going to have to come elsewhere.
Well, and when they took Okafor, they already had Nerlens and Embiid in tow. Even if Embiid wasn't playing, Nerlens was still, you know, working his way back to 100% from the injury and all that.
Yeah,
right.
So, I mean, that's kind of, having Nerlens and Okafor seems kind of counterintuitive because none of those guys, you know, are really going to spread the floor in the modern NBA sense, even if Nerlens offers a little more defensively.
Yeah, no, it was definitely a situation where from the moment he got here, it was not the best thing for either party. I would venture to guess that when Sam Hinkie drafted him, it was probably with the notion in mind that he'd be able to deal him for plus value. That just seems like that's the mindset he went into a lot of moves with, including when he selected Elfrid Payton and then flipped him to Orlando in the draft prior. But that clearly didn't work out, and it ended up ending pretty poorly for everybody involved.
I want to ask you about Sam Hinkie. I'm glad you brought him up. Because me and Derek have always kind of talked about it, and our guy Steve McPherson, when he was doing this podcast with us too, we always kind of talked about, you know, the process and Sam Hinkie. And Sam Hinkie got under a lot of fire nationally just because the Sixers were not good, and there was just this thought of, you know, they're not trying to put a competitive team together.
It's an affront to the competitive spirit.
Yeah, and so Hinkie got a lot of criticism from a lot of people. But now he's not with the organization anymore, and they have, you know, other people in the front office making moves and decisions. If the Sixers reach the level that I think a lot of people think that they have the potential to reach in a few years, how much credit should Sam Hinkie get for that, for sort of starting this rebuilding process, you know, 5-6 years ago?
I don't even think we necessarily need to go that far out. I mean, you can look at what they have right now, and like we can even set aside Ben Simmons. He didn't pick him, but he was the obvious number one pick in that year after they had their disaster season. So
yeah.
He got Joel Embiid, and while it looks like that's the obvious and easy pick now, there was a ton of backlash here, maybe more so nationally, that, oh, they took another injured big man after taking Nerlens Noel. How could you do this? He's never going to be healthy, et cetera, et cetera. And now he's one of the best, I don't know, 15, 20 players in the league right now, I would say. But the more important stuff to me as a GM are the moves you make around the margins. And you look at a Robert Covington, a guy that he got out of the D League and is now a 60 million plus player who's an integral part of that rotation.
I love him.
Yeah, Covington's probably one of my favorite players and stories in the league, honestly. You look at Rashawn Holmes, who we mentioned briefly. That's a guy that Hinkie took in the second round, is now like a legitimate rotation big. That's a real find. You look at TJ McConnell, another undrafted guy who looked like he could barely be on an NBA floor when you first saw him in preseason and summer league a few years ago. And because he got a lot of developmental reps under Brett Brown, with the opportunity provided by having sort of an open rotation at the time, now he's a legitimate backup point guard. So I think those are the moves that are probably more indicative of why they did what they did, or the exact reasons they did what they did. Because, look, it's the superstars are what's going to drive this forward. But the places where the GMs really make their money are when they fill in with the role players and they get guys on the right contracts, below market contracts, and you have these valuable guys on your team without pricing yourself up to the salary cap. So I think Hinkie deserves plenty of credit. I think from here on out, we'll get to see what Brian Colangelo can do with all that space. I know that that front office has prioritized. They want to chase max free agents next summer. I don't know that LeBron is going to come to Philadelphia, and I think that's sort of a pipe dream, but they very much want to be at the table with guys like that next year.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. So you got a chance to get a look at the Wolves this past Tuesday, and what's sort of your assessment from afar of them, just where they're at with, you know, Jimmy Butler and Wiggins and Towns, and, you know, what's your take on what you've seen from the Wolves?
So I want to sort of throw a question back at you guys on
sure.
this one. Are you guys disappointed with the way the defense is looking there, especially considering the coach and the reputation you guys have is? Because it seems like with some of the personnel that they have, that they should at least be a little past where they are right now. I think certainly that Jimmy Butler is an awesome player. I'm a big believer in Towns long term, but right now I think my biggest thing with Towns, and this has become a huge talking point around the league, I know I'm not exactly splitting the atom bringing it up here, but his defense is not where I thought it would be when I started watching him back at his freshman year at Kentucky.
No, I think you're spot on with that. I don't think any of us, and you know, whether we're, you know, media or fans or whoever following the team, I mean, that's really been the, like you said, the surprise there, given Tom Thibodeau's reputation. And with Kevin Garnett and Towns' rookie year, you know, we thought like, okay, yeah, you know, Towns, you know, solid rookie year on the defensive end, but he's really just regressed each year. And the first year it made sense, you know, a little bit, you know, all right, new coach, you know, this is, you know, right. his X number of coaches in however many years, it's just going to take some time to come around. And he hasn't really put it together on that end in this year either. And that's the concerning thing. I mean, being in year three now, the first couple of years, I think, with a player like that is that, you know,
give him a
first
pass.
Couple of years, yeah, you give him a pass on that. But then with a player of his caliber, with his potential, I mean, I think you hold him to a higher standard. And you would consider this regression from where he started. And that's kind of the concerning thing. And it really just does affect everything else, because there was a GIF that you put in your piece from the game that I saw. It was, I don't remember which one. I think it was the pass out to, no, it was the back door.
It's to Simmons. I know the exact.
Yeah. The back door Simmons.
About a minute left, and he just sort of floating in no man's land, impacting nothing, and Simmons gets the open layup.
Yeah, he seemingly went to defend the, to help on the three-point line. In the meantime, Joel Embiid was wide open, and then Butler had to pull up, and that freed up Simmons.
Right, because he went over to try and help Teague with Redick, but Teague didn't need, like, Teague was in a pretty good position.
It was a contested shot at best.
Yeah, and Towns ended up drifting over there, and then when he realized that Teague didn't need any help, he just tried to drift back, and at that point, he'd lost Embiid and didn't know what he was going to do. He was just in the middle of the floor, like, just lost. And that's been kind of a normal thing. It's where
plays like that where Taj just kind of pulled his hair out.
Yeah.
You know, just, you know, you see his reactions to the things that Towns does. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely a well-known thing, and you see an example every night. I mean, he did have a couple plays on Embiid, the back-to-back blocks that were pretty exciting, but I mean, I don't ever really equate that type of playmaking to defensive ability.
Right.
You know what I mean?
No, I totally agree. Yeah, I think that's part of why I think it's easier to discuss offense with the average person than it is defense, because if someone like the average NBA fan or even media person sees Karl Towns guard Joel Embiid in the post last night, they say, oh, wow, Towns had a pretty good game on defense. He did a good job slowing Embiid down, made him work for his points. Like, I think he did a completely adequate job of taking over that one-on-one assignment when it was given to him.
It's like the NBA defense 101.
Yeah, like the problem is the NBA is increasingly played in space and guys having to make rotations and switches and all sorts of different things where you have to read traffic that's coming at you at 100 miles an hour. And
yep.
that to me, that, I mean, look, I don't want to turn this into an anti-Towns thing. I still think he's a huge talent, a really good player.
Right.
And, like, this is the sort of problem that plagues a lot of young guys. And he's still very young, so there's still a ton of reason to believe that eventually he'll be able to turn the size and the athleticism that he has into better, more impactful defense. But that's certainly something that I did not think was going to be as big a problem as it is at this stage of his career.
Yeah, I think a similar issue that he and Wiggins have both had this year especially is their one-on-one defense. Like you talked about, Towns' sort of his one-on-one defense against Embiid was solid. And it's been kind of the same thing with Wiggins too, where if you have Andrew Wiggins just guard a guy one-on-one, he usually does okay.
He's 6'8", and he's athletic as heck.
Right, but yeah. What happens is when teams start swinging the ball and they start moving the ball all over the floor, Wiggins and Towns, they just, whether it's lack of focus or lack of like understanding exactly what to do or where to be, they just get lost, and it throws the entire chain of defense off, and then other guys have to overcompensate.
I forgot who brought this up, but they pointed out that it's not just that first rotation and, okay, good, I made my rotation, I'm done. It's the other ones that come after that, you know, if necessary, that you still have to stay engaged and locked in on. And that's something that Wiggins and Towns haven't really picked up on yet, which is a problem because they're on the floor a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was, so to circle back to the Sixers real quick, that was my biggest gripe and a lot of people's biggest gripe with Jahlil Okafor. I don't think his problem was when he was asked to guard guys one-on-one. When he's presented with, like, let's say a Hassan Whiteside or somebody like that in the post, I think he did an adequate job of, look, he's keeping them in front of him, he's banging with them in the post, he's not fouling them, and he'll get a decent enough contest on whatever shot he puts up. But when you put him in space and you ask him to make reads, it starts to fall apart. And so people end up seeing the end result, which is someone else's guy from the beginning of the possession getting an open three or getting a dunk or a layup or whatever type of shot it ends up being, and they don't think it's on Okafor when his breakdown in the rotation is what caused that chain reaction to begin with. So I that's the way I try to look at defense, is who's the one that breaks the chain that leads to the open shot, and I think that should be how we try to look at defense more and more as people who follow basketball.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is we hear Tibbs after every game, you know, he keeps saying, you know, we got to stick with the defensive scheme, or I mean, what is he
move on a chain?
Yeah, move on a chain. I mean, it's so much about, you know, everybody being connected, and when one guy breaks that chain, I mean, it just impacts everything else, and the next thing you know, somebody's got a wide open corner three and they drill it. And when you're the Wolves and you're not really a great 3-point shooting team and you're allowing teams to drain corner threes on you every other possession, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard for you to catch up if you're down, and it's going to be hard for you to maintain a lead down the stretch if you're trying to hold one. So that is,
yeah, well, the good news is both Wiggins and Towns are still super young,
yes,
and have plenty of time where they can work on that as a staple of their game. So, I mean, for the good of the league, I hope that both those guys start to hone in more on that.
Is Brett Brown, I mean, how does he sort of connect with the players? Because I think that's kind of something that's been questioned here with Tibbs a little bit, is just sort of that connection with the players and getting the players to buy into the defensive system. But how is Brett Brown sort of connected with this group in Philadelphia? I mean, and he's been a part of this, you know, this process since day one too. So he's experienced a lot of losses.
Too.
Yeah. And he's been taking it on the chin, man, in terms of just the amount of losses that he's had to endure, and he's still standing there and doing a great job. So how is he sort of related to these players?
Yeah, he's going to need a lot of 50-win seasons to be able to erase what he went through. I think he gets along, from what I can tell, I think the players really respect him. I think that's a big reason why he was able to survive that down period. I mean, a lot of franchises, had they undergone a rebuild like this, they would have used the coach as sort of a, I don't want to say a scapegoat, but you sort of, you make a clean break. You bring in a new guy, and it's a new era, and fresh ideas, all that stuff.
Yeah, we've seen that here a few times.
Yeah. But because the teams, even with as little talent as they had at times, because they played so hard night after night, and because those guys really went to bat for Brown and really just have a strong personal bond with him, it seems like, I think that's why the management was willing to bring him back here, see what he can do this year, and maybe if things hadn't gone right this year, that they would have brought in a more experienced or maybe more playoff-ready coach. But I think there are a lot of signs that Brown was able to do the things a good coach needs to do. I think the Sixers this year have actually been one of the better teams on after-timeout plays, which those are some of the sequences that a coach is able to exert the most influence on a game. I think they play with a clear style, as they have even through the tough years. They space the floor, they play with pace, and they want to beat teams on the defensive end. Now, obviously, he's been helped by the personnel he has there. I think pretty much any coach gets handed Joel Embiid, who's one of the most impactful defenders in the league, you're going to be able to build a pretty decent defense. But yeah. I think the way the players play for him, the way there was never really – I don't think I can recall any sort of player-coach – dust up or issue during his entire tenure here. And I think given how low this team sunk at times and how much possibility there was for something like that, I think that speaks very highly to him as not just as a coach, but as a person. And I think at the end of the day, just his humanity and just his, he's a very unique guy among coaches. I know, Derek, if you're at the games doing interviews with these guys, I don't know how Brett is on the road, but compared to the availability we get with other coaches here, he is very open and forthcoming and willing to give you a lot of his time, which is pretty unique in my experience.
Well, I was actually going to drop my two cents on that. So I remember a couple of years ago, Brett Brown came in. Brett Brown's always been fantastic. Whenever he's come in, I mean, he gives good answers, you know, not just cliches. But, I mean, what I've kind of noticed is he just seems a lot happier now. Like, his demeanor just seems...
Oh, for sure.
I mean, because he came in a couple years ago, and I mean, he just went out there, kind of touted the company line, but it almost sounded like Stockholm Syndrome to an extent, that it was just kind of a difficult and frustrating time. And, you know, but he never, you know, threw anyone under the bus, never seemed frustrated with the situation, you know, like he was getting a raw deal or anything like that, or there was any pressure on him.
And then those rough years where they were in the bottom of the standings, those teams, they played hard. They weren't very talented, but they played hard.
They didn't lay down for anybody. I mean, they still got blown out on a lot of nights, I would say, more often than not. But it was never because they weren't out there working hard. And to me, like those are where, like, even look at somewhere like a Phoenix this year before Earl Watson got fired. That team was just sleepwalking through games. That was not a matter of, oh, we don't have the guys. That was, look, we don't really care. We're mailing it in. So I never really sensed that in Brown's tenure. And, yeah, to Derek's point, he's just a very upbeat, positive guy. And I think you would have to be able to suffer through all those lean years as the head coach.
Well, especially when everyone's picking your team to win 13 games. I think everyone picked them to, you know, be the worst team in the league for about 3 years in a row. And there was only one year where they were, and I think they still won like 21 games or something like that. So I think they always, you know, outdid their expectations. And I mean, that really just shows that, you know, he's able to really instill a sense of pride in these guys and still have them to come to work, you know, every single day, even when they know that they might not be the most talented team on the court most nights.
For sure. Well, and the crazy thing now is now that the Philadelphia fan base let's say they were not trusting the process before this year, the fans that are coming back this season, now that they're good, any game the Sixers lose, it's always Brett Brown's fault. it's Brett Brown deserves to be fired tomorrow. That's basically the explanation after the game. So that part has been a little jarring because, I mean, look, they've had some crunch time struggles this year at times. They're a young team. They're relying on a 21-year-old, 6'10" point guard and a guy who has played, to his own admission, maybe 100 total basketball games in his lifetime. I think that's like the craziest thing about Joel Embiid. People talk about, oh, he's only played, I guess, what, 50-something professional games now?
Yeah.
He barely played basketball at all compared to most of these guys.
That's so unfair.
And somehow he's still as good as he is, which that's the thing that boggles my mind every day, that this kid was only really started playing in his late teens and is still already one of the best basketball players on the planet.
See, when you talk about the fans, I remember when we were a couple of years into the process and everything, and non-Sixers fans were talking about really just critical of the process and everything, and fans are like, "Hey, we've won 38, 41 games and been bounced in the first or second round every single year. We're tired of this, and the teams are awful to watch. I mean, they were not fun to watch. I remember those teams, and so it just seemed like that they were just so." Most of them seemed pretty welcoming towards just a total fresh direction, even if it meant being a miserable team in the short term. So, I mean, it's sort of just to hear that, fans coming back, which is understandable. I mean, in Philadelphia especially, there are so many ways to spend your money.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. So you're seeing, I mean, there was definitely, myself included, there was definitely a large contingent of fans that were, look, I'd watch those Iguodala-led teams beat their head into the wall over and over again, lose to, but they were mediocre, but they also lost to a bunch of mediocre teams in the playoffs. So, I mean, they were the bottom of the barrel for mediocre teams even. So
yeah.
A ton of people were just tired of going through that same, going through the motions. I mean, even at the end of Iverson's tenure, they were just grasping at straws, trying to bring somebody in to play with him, and they never really found that second guy.
Like Chris Webber, wasn't it?
Chris Webber, yeah.
Yeah, post-torn knee Chris Webber. They brought in guys like Corliss Williamson and Kenny Thomas.
Oh, Lord.
All these, this is just an assortment of guys. Keith Van Horn. I mean, they drafted Larry Hughes instead of Paul Pierce or Dirk Nowitzki, which is obviously the big one that got away there. One of those guys would have been pretty nice.
He could have been the Bucks and traded him for Robert Traylor, so don't feel too bad.
Oh, God, yeah. I guess that's even worse. So there were a ton of people that were just happy to, even if it was going to take a few years to reset things, just to get that ball rolling and change what was going on in Philadelphia. Obviously, that wasn't everybody. I know nationally there was a ton of criticism, but if you guys listen to any sports talk radio in Philadelphia during those years, you would know there are plenty of dissenters. So I think a lot of them are back now that they have the good players that were the product of being that bad, which is an interesting phenomenon to me. But I'm just glad to see it's nice for those guys to show up to that arena and see a sold-out crowd after some of them had to sit through some really ugly losses and play in some empty arenas, both at home and around the league.
Yeah, it's kind of a similar thing here. I mean, me and Derek, we've grown up, following the Wolves, and we experienced some lean years over the years, and now finally, after so long, they're even with all the frustration that they've probably brought us this season. I mean, they're 16-12. As of this taping,
good frustration. And you have something to care about.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's been fun. But Kyle, gosh, man, we could talk with you all night about this because this is fun though. We've got two young teams, up and coming teams that are that hopefully will be good for a while here, and who knows?
Just the interest too, even with the media. I mean, I think most of the questions Tom Thibodeau got in his pregame availability were about the Sixers, and which is insane because the Wolves are a young and exciting team who are also playing well. So, I mean, I think, for years to come, these should be two teams that are talked about a lot and often in the same sentence.
Yeah, I hope one day we see these teams in the finals, and maybe we'll all get to go out for a beer between finals games in Minnesota or something.
Absolutely. I can dig that. Kyle, thanks a lot. Kyle Newbeck from the Philly Voice and phillyvoice.com. Thank you, sir. We'll have you on again soon.
All right. Thanks, guys.
The Sixers are I mean, I said it before the season that if there was a team, obviously, besides the Wolves that I was going to be really intrigued by, it was going to be the Sixers because we were going to see Ben Simmons for the first time and hopefully a healthy Embiid, which we've seen now.
I mean, I think they were always fun. Intriguing, but I think once we actually saw the product, you know, the first time I saw Ben Simmons, I was like, okay. All right, this team could really be something now that Simmons is actually going to, you know, be an impact player. So, I mean, it's a lot of fun. Embiid's playing. I mean, they got exciting guys. You know, Rashawn Holmes just adding Trevor Booker. I'm way too excited about Trevor Booker. I almost tried to stop him to talk to him about his draft workout just because that would have been fun. But he had his AirPods or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Which, I mean, hey, when you're an NBA player, you can afford to spend $100 on a pair of headphones. You're probably losing 10 minutes.
They started four of their five starters were 6'10 and taller.
Yeah.
Last night. That's, I mean, now Robert Covington is...
J.J. Redick is about an inch taller than me.
Yeah.
Which is, he's the shortest guy on the floor.
Yeah, that's they are quite the unique team. And you know what? If they stay healthy, they're not going anywhere, man. They're going to be around. And the Eastern Conference especially is going to be,
You think that the Bucks would have wished that they did something similar for Giannis? Because now you just look at their payroll and the guys they have around Giannis, and the light doesn't seem as bright at the end of the tunnel for them, despite having a player of that caliber.
And he's another one that's incredible. I think, you know what? I think the NBA is in good hands as far as young players.
Isn't it crazy? We had that lull after Jordan retired where it was the Duncan and Kobe show for all those years. I mean, Shaq was kind of winding down, but I mean, it's been a golden age for a few years, and it doesn't look like that's going away anytime soon.
Yeah, it's great stuff. All right, before we get out of here, thanks to Kyle Newbeck again for joining us. So the elephant in the room with this team, being the Wolves, is the minutes, and that much has been made about it. They played this overtime game with the Sixers last night. So just looking at the box score, Taj Gibson, 40 minutes. Andrew Wiggins, 40 minutes. Cat, 48. Jeff Teague, 38. Jimmy Butler, 46. Now, obviously, this is an overtime game, so there's always going to be a little bit more minutes played there. But it's the elephant in the room. It's what everybody wants to talk about. It's what everybody's sort of frustrated with on a local level, national level, what have you. What do they do? I mean, we've kind of talked about it. Can you get Cole Aldrich a few minutes? If Shabazz is not going to play, if Shabazz has played himself out of the rotation, can Marcus Georges Hunt play himself into the rotation? Can he give you 5 minutes one night and give you a good little something and you're like, huh, maybe you could play him a little bit more?
Well, we just talked about Robert Covington with Kyle.
Yeah.
I mean, you never know. You got to find these guys somewhere. And I mean, I know it's not custom for playoff teams and teams looking for wins to start breaking in young guys to get them their first NBA experience. But even just 5 minutes, I mean, if Shabazz Muhammad is your bar right now, that's not a high bar to clear. And I've even kind of softened up on the nail Shabazz to the bench thing, even as bad as he's been, because clearly you need to preserve the core guys for the rest of the season. You can't keep doing this. I mean, so if Gorgui Dieng is only playing 8 minutes through three quarters, I mean, what are you doing? We saw how it affected Taj already, and it's not even Christmas. So, I mean, you tell me Cole Aldrich can't come in, grab a couple boards, take a couple fouls, and maybe, you know, get a couple buckets here and there, even just for 5 minutes a game. I mean, I think Mackie pointed this out on Mackie and Judd today, that J.J. Redick played, 39 minutes. Timothée Luwawu, also known as TLC.
Yep.
Came in and played 4 minutes, hit a three-pointer, dished out an assist, grabbed a rebound, and that was it. Yeah. And Redick was able to hit some key shots down the stretch, and especially in overtime, he was still a factor because he had those fresher legs. And yet we saw, you know, a lot of the Wolves wearing out, and it's just something you can't expect to sustain. And, I mean, this team could play with Philly, and Philly is a playoff team. I mean, I don't think the Western Conference is what it was. So I don't think you can even say, yeah, but it's the East. You know, this is still a very good team, a team that, you know, the Wolves should, you know, are kind of going to be compared to, whether fair or unfair, because they both have young generational talent. Well, seemingly generational talent, I guess I should say. And, you know, you want to be able to keep pace with these guys to be able to beat these teams and, you know, be able to have those wins in your pocket as the season goes on to say, you know, we've already beaten some quality teams. You know, this is just another one that we're up against, because they still have the Rockets, the Cavs, the Celtics, more Warriors, the Spurs. Yeah. I mean, it's not getting any easier, and I'm still not convinced the Thunder are going to be this wretched all year long.
Yeah, and, you know, and the Thunder are another team that you're just kind of wondering about, just like, come on, you know.
And they may never wake up, but yeah. I'm betting on them waking up at some point.
Not going to bank on it. I just would like to see, look, Tom Thibodeau knows way more about basketball than I could even dream of, okay? So, like, I'm not...
single guy, no kids, this is his life.
Yes. So, I'm not trying to even pretend to be smarter than him. But if he were sitting here, I guess I would just ask him, is there a way where you can be a little bit more creative with your rotations and the delegation of minutes? I mean, because you cannot sustain an 8-man rotation. You got 50, you know, they're 16-12. So they've got what? That's 54 games left. You're a third of the way through the season. You cannot sustain an 8-man rotation for the remaining 2/3 of the season. It's not, you just, guys are tired. Guys get tired. I mean, you just
my biggest fear with that is that we're looking at this team, we're feeling pretty good. Yeah, you know, they're in the top four. You know, they could have home court in the first round, which would obviously be ideal.
Mm-hmm.
But if the workload doesn't decrease for, you know, the main guys, I think we may look back on this, you know, if they maybe scratch a playoff spot or if they fall out just because they just don't have anything left. I mean, because the big thing that we've seen is that this team, seemingly they hit their top gear and that's it. There is no boost or anything.
Yeah.
That's as good as it gets. I mean, they don't get blown out a lot, but they don't really blow out teams either. I think they beat the Pelicans by 18 that one night. But those double-digit wins really haven't been a big thing. And we look at their fourth. They're the worst fourth-quarter team in the NBA right now.
Yeah.
And you figure they're playing so many minutes the first three quarters, maybe that's impacting them. And, I mean, Jimmy Butler gave the most Jimmy Butler answer to questions about fatigue. He said, if we're tired, maybe we need to run more laps in practice. But in all seriousness.
I love him, man. He's
you know, and the thing is, Taj was also asked about it. I mean, they're Thibodeau guys. So, I mean, they're going to go to bat for their coach, of course. Yeah. And you wouldn't expect them to do anything else.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think deep down, they got to do something.
Yeah. Can you find some minutes for Marcus George's Hunt? Can you call Anthony Brown up from the G League and get
if you don't want to play Boz, play somebody else.
Yes. I mean, because you have to.
You don't
have
a healthy Bielitsa, which did you hear Doogie on?
I saw your tweets on that, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess apparently if Bielitsa, you know, we're getting the more minutes, you know, I mean, he's in a contract year, he would be playing right now, is what Doogie said. Which is interesting. I mean, but I mean, why come back in a contract year, not be 100%, re-injure yourself if you're not even going to play that
if
much?
You're only going to play 12 minutes a night, then what's the...
Might as well wait till you're 100%. I mean, I don't think that's, you know, being selfish or anything, because in my interactions with Belly, I mean, he is the most polite guy in the world. If he bumped, you know, if you bumped into him, he'd probably say sorry to you. I mean, that's just who he is.
And look, when he was out there, you know, before he got hurt, he was playing well. He was playing well. That was one of our, at least between you and I, like that was one of our concerns was, okay, is this ever really going to work out for Belly? You know, he just, people want him to be a stretch four, but he's not shooting well, blah, blah, blah. And then he's, when he was playing this year, he was playing well. He was shooting well.
He was a flamethrower.
Yes. So, I mean, they miss him certainly. I mean, the sooner he can get back, the better. Obviously, you don't want to rush him back if he's not ready to go.
Well, especially when you have a guy like Bielitsa, whose game is predicated so much on the cutting. And when he's at his best, he's putting the ball on the floor, he's driving, he's kicking it out, and all those things. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if it's his, whether it's his foot or his knee or whatever it is this week, you want to make sure it's 100%, because typically when you injure those, I mean, it's not uncommon to have the other side go out too, or re-injure it, or make it worse. And you really don't want that, especially with a guy who has been susceptible to a few injuries in his time here.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see how things go in the next couple of weeks. I mean, it's becoming, I mean, it's been, Tibbs has been playing the starters heavy minutes pretty much all season, but it's really, I think after last night's game where, you know, you just see Taj just kind of fall out after the third quarter because he's just out of gas. I think people are really starting to chirp about it and make some noise about it. And so, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if Tibbs is hearing any of it and see if he makes any adjustments. You know, the players have kind of hinted at it a little bit. So, I don't know. We'll see how things go here in the next couple of weeks. I would like to see, like we were saying with Jace Frederick last week, I want to see if Marcus George's Hunt can play. I want to see if he can play, if he can give them anything.
It'd just be a fun thing. But, I mean, as Jimmy Butler said last night, I don't have all the answers.
You can find the Raised by Wolves podcast on iTunes, of course, at podcast1.com and, of course, 1500ESPN.com. Thanks to Kyle Newbeck for joining us from the Philly Voice. And be sure to follow him at Kyle Newbeck if you want some good Sixers stuff there. Thanks to you at home for listening to the Raised by Wolves podcast. I'm Manny Hill for Derek James, and enjoy your Wolves basketball. We'll talk to you next week.